ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome back to the Green Dot EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts, Hal Bryan, EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. Sitting off to my right just a little bit, it is...
I'm Chris Henry, the museum manager here in Oshkosh.
Chris, we're lucky to have a guest right here in person with us, not even the magic of the internet this time.
I know. As much as I love the magic of the internet... Really enjoy having guests in person, and tonight we're very fortunate to have Dr. Brett Hoffman here with us. He's from the University of Wisconsin MIA Recovery and Identification Project. Dr. Hoffman, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, no, thank you all for having me here. This has been something I've been looking forward to, and I'm very happy to be here and share what our project's doing, what we're all about, and what we're going to try to do moving forward.
And as we're recording this, Dr. Hoffman, or Brett, is here to speak at the museum. So hopefully some out there listening will have attended by the time this is recorded out there. But for the rest of you, we'll give you a little bit of a taste of what you might have missed.
Well, absolutely. And this is a little bit of a different topic for us, but I think it's really interesting. Tell us a little bit about sort of an overview of what the program is.
Yeah, I'll try to do it as succinctly as possible. And coherently as well, which is always a challenge. So the project started because there is a agency within the Department of Defense called, it's now called the DPAA, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. And they are charged with investigating all missing service members globally that served in any U.S. armed forces at any period in time. At last count, there are over 82,000 of these cases open. And this amount of work and the amount of things that need to be investigated are too much to do solely with the organic teams that the DPAA has on hand. So they started several years back, they started a partnerships program where they try to work with other organizations that may have individuals or groups of individuals that have the skill sets needed to do this. And so the UWMIA project came about in a collaboration where they did some DNA testing, and I'll show some images and talk a little bit more about that this evening, for the DPAA. And that started them taking missions for the DPAA on a contract basis. And what we've grown into is we have a variety of people that have a diverse set of skill sets, historians, biochemists, archaeologists, archival researchers, a whole cadre of student volunteers, veteran volunteers, volunteers from the public. And what we do is we go out and we're given a case by the DPAA, and then we go out and we use archaeological field techniques to locate and try to recover missing service members from what we primarily focused on is World War II aircraft crashes from the European theater. But these missions happen all over the globe, right? From everywhere from the highest mountains to under the sea, And everything in between.
Wow, that's really remarkable. So you've developed this focus, and I want to get into that more deeply, on aircraft in Europe, but across the board with this, what did you say, it was 82,000 open cases?
I believe that's roughly the approximate number that, right, you know, that the Defense Department is aware of, that they have sure. These individuals unaccounted for.
And that can be unaccounted for under any circumstances. And you said truly from any era. So we're not just talking air crew or, you know, downed aircraft, although I'm sure there must be a pretty substantial amount of that, especially when you start talking about aviators lost in the water or in remote areas that may not have been in there on foot, but it's truly everything.
To my knowledge, yes. I haven't looked at all of the cases, but sure. What I've always in my discussions with the senior leadership of UWMIA is because when I first started doing this, I didn't know anything about these missions. I didn't know anything about this agency within the Defense Department. I didn't know anything about the partnership program. I didn't know anything about any of this. So I've been learning over the last several years as my involvement with the project has grown more about this. But you are correct. My understanding is it's any period in time in any lost case. It could be training, it could be, you know, we have several aircraft that do get lost on training flights, right? You know, so many sure. trainers went up and only so many came back and nobody knows what happened. to combat losses. And then there are kind of, you know, losses at sea or in rivers, and then there's air losses, and then there are like terrestrial ground losses where, you know, it was an infantry situation or something like that, that are also on part of that number that makes up that larger list of missing service members.
Right. So you're talking about taking on these cases on this contract basis. Are you, or is somebody from your group, are they looking at open cases and saying, hey, we could help with that one, we could help with that one? Or are they approaching you? And what's the criteria for you to take on a case?
So there's several ways that we, when I say we, I mean the UWMIA. And I want to stress that the senior leadership, the UWMIA, makes these decisions. I'm just kind of one member of an overall team that contributes kind of the archaeological stuff I know, but I do know the overview of the process that you were just asking about. So when we do a contract or a mission for the DPAA, they essentially come to us as a partner and they say, we have this case, it's the loss of XYZ crew members from this type of aircraft, you know, in this location, here's all the basic information, you know, and we work with them to put together a timeline and a budget. And then we go try to execute that mission and hopefully successfully recover missing air crew members and bring them home to their families to be reunited. Then there's other work that our group has started to do. And this is outside of the DPAA. We're trying to expand our work and increase our work, working specifically with Wisconsin's missing. And you know, our state has been touched by missing service members throughout history in every corner of our state. There's no community, there's no region of our state, there's no group of people that haven't been touched by this issue. And so one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to raise money, generate volunteers, and create additional projects, additional things we can do to specifically help address, you know, reuniting or bringing closure to families from Wisconsin that have missing service members in their ranks, so to speak.
Wow.
That's incredible. Can you tell me a little bit about how did you get started in this? What was your path and your first interest in it?
So my path is that I'm an anthropologist, and specifically the kind of anthropology I do is archaeology, right? So what my training and background is that I dig up the trash that prehistoric people leave behind. That's the quickest way to summarize archaeology if you've never heard about it before and you've never thought about it before. It is not like what you see in TVs and movies. Unfortunately, it would be great if it was.
So no fedora, no whip.
I don't know how to use a whip. I don't own a fedora. I have never punched a Nazi.
hey, you're young.
Right. There's still time. But it's using basic techniques, no matter where you study archaeology or like what time period. For instance, my background for my PhD thesis was on a 5,000-year-old Bronze Age civilization that occupies the current Indus River area of modern-day India and Pakistan. These cities were large metropolitan centers during the time of the pyramids, roughly. I'm playing a little fast and loose with the chronology to peg it to something that I think most of the audience will have heard. In case anybody does know the exact chronology, they can't yell at me too much. And that's kind of what I did. And then also in the meantime, great, graduate school took a long time. It takes a long time to finish all these projects. And you know, in the meantime, you have to pay rent and other bills and stuff. And oftentimes, many people may have experienced this. If you were doing a construction or development project, you have to do an archaeological survey, a historical survey, prior to that new road going in or that new development coming in down the road. And this is something which archaeologists do all across the state of Wisconsin all the time. And so I did a lot of work in that sector of archaeology over the last decade plus. And in that, I met some people and I met some colleagues and I made some connections. And the lead archaeologist of the UWMIA program, he's going to be mad that I dropped his name, but Dr. Greg Jameson is our lead archaeologist. And I have a professional and personal relationship with him for more years than I can remember right now. And so as our scope of work grew in these DPAA missions, as we needed to take more people into the field project was a larger area. We needed more people that were well-trained and had a background in this. And he asked me if I'd be willing to do it. And I kind of jumped at the chance and jumped on board a moving train To my mind, I the first time I did this, I think my eyes didn't blink for 4 or 5 days. I you know, trying to figure out what's going on. And then, you know, I've tried to contribute my skill set as an archaeologist and my knowledge as an archaeologist to the team and the volunteers and the other members moving forward for that from that point.
So when you're your group is assigned a case and you know, or maybe step us through one of your cases, but with the idea of being, you know, where do you start? What's the first thing that you do? Is the hardest part finding a crash site, or do you usually know?
Yeah, you
know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
How do we get there?
Certainly. So usually by the time it gets to one of DPAA's partners, whether it's our team at UWMIA or one of the other ventures they work with, there is already a location on the ground, so to speak, somewhere in the world that they're pretty sure, at least I'm going to restrict it to World War II era aircraft. That's, sure. That's what I know best. So maybe if we just focus on that, that somebody is very sure that in this area, say a farm field, right, between this intersection and that crossroad, you know, that a U.S., military plane, there's evidence of a crash there, right? The question is, what plane? How much evidence, right? And so then what they try to do, every plane that's gone missing and every individual air crew member that went missing during the war ideally has generated a missing air crew report. And in that, it gives very specific details, as one might imagine, and I'm sure your experience here at the museum bears out, right? The military has got serial numbers on everything, and ideally, in theory, they know which crew members went up with which ship on which day. And so what you do is you then say, okay, we have evidence. There's usually done by DPAA themselves, what's called a scouting mission. Somebody has reported this area, right? It's become known. And so people go and they look and they say, oh, over there, you know, look, that's a piece of aluminum that, you know, looks like the kind of aluminum these aircraft were skinned in. Or maybe over here, there's some writing, you know, on a piece, and that's definitely of the right era. Or, you know, maybe they got a data plate even, right? Or whatever the case may be. So, okay, we need to do a much more detailed investigation of this. Then they send an archaeological team out, whether it's one of DPAA's organic teams or a partner institution like UWMIA, and we go out and we survey the area using archaeological techniques, and then we excavate the area using archaeological techniques, which is the kind of stuff people get in their mind. We're digging square holes in a grid, shaking the dirt through mesh screens, and then we're recording and counting what we find. And what we're looking for is something that can link this crash site to a specific aircraft is one of the first steps. So you're looking for those data plates, those things with serial numbers on them, those things that existing historical and archival records can tie to a specific craft. And then the next part of our mission is to continue to excavate, and we start looking for identifying materials of the missing service members, right? These can be things ranging from personal artifacts, right? Life-saving equipment that may demonstrate somebody was with the aircraft, and then up to and including human remains. And then we recover those using high quality professional standards of archaeological practice. And we then record and document. And that's where we work collaboratively with the analysis department of the DPAA. And we send all those materials to these massive forensic laboratories. There's one in Nebraska and one in Hawaii. And they analyze the results of these field missions and try to see if these field missions were successful in their objective of recovering and repatriating remains of missing service members.
Wow. When you're on site and you're actually doing like an excavation, how long are you usually there for? Like, what's the time frame?
The time frame is quite short. We're usually there for somewhere between 3 and 5 weeks, say somewhere in that window. And we have, you know, the team sizes have ranged, but that's one of the things that really needs to be stressed is the commitment, dedication, and passion of our volunteer team members. Our volunteers range from you know, grumpy old folks like myself to young students, right, to veterans, to people with no connection to the military or the historical or period we're working in. And we work in rain or shine all day, every day, 10+ hour days, 6 days a week. And I have never had a crew member on the UWAMIA project say anything else to me but yes to anything they're asked to do, no matter. And it's physical work. I mean, it's, we excavate these things largely by hand. We, even if they're excavated by a machine, right, like some sort of backhoe, they still end up as piles of dirt. That dirt has to be bucketed and hauled by hand to the screening stations and then ran through the screening stations by hand manually. And then on top of that, you have to do, you know, write things down and record things. So these are long, difficult days. And our team members have never done anything but done all of it and then asked for more.
Well, it's a... one of the only words I can come up with to describe it is it's a noble effort. And I mean that quite sincerely, that it's powerful stuff. I would imagine, and maybe this is something you can describe or just, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but that, you know, when these things are starting and you're working, there's maybe some initial lightness and excitement when you find a potential clue, or here's a bit of thing that really looks like it's part of an airframe, or, you know, oh my gosh, here's the data plate. But as you're going through that, does the mood, I would think it must, does the mood change when you've gotten to a point where now you're finding human remains?
So I can't totally speak to that. The missions I have been on with the UWMIA, we have not found positively correlated and identified human remains. My colleagues have been, and they've shared with me as best they can that experience. The short answer is you can't really describe it until you've gone through it, but I know it's powerful, and I have seen people that I've known for long periods of time become visibly emotional and just thinking about it and talking about it. One of the most powerful things I've seen, and I haven't directly experienced it, is that all across Europe, there are the official American cemeteries. Is that something you're familiar with?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, in each American cemetery, there will be an area for the missing, right? And then if you ever are able to identify and find these missing people, they put a little rosette next to the name. And I have seen our team members visit American cemeteries where the UWMIA's efforts have put a rosette on his names. And I've seen people just need to take quite some time to work through that experience. And while I have never been on one of these missions where we have recovered human remains, what does come into your head is, as an archaeologist, we always like to find things, right? And I like the puzzle of archaeology. You're finding things in the screen that some of these places, if it's the size of a dime, you're like, wow, that's really big, right? Very small, these quarter inch mesh screens, you can imagine how small things we can recover. And you're trying to piece together what you're looking at, right? How did it end up like this from what it was originally, you know, this kind of aircraft or you know, in my other work, this kind of artifact. But what I'm struck at when I'm working with the UWMA projects is that these are grave sites in my mind. Sure. Even if you know, the War Graves Commission shortly after the incident came and removed and reburied bodies, or oftentimes local people put them in the adjacent village cemetery. And so if there was never any individuals buried on this location, this is still where somebody experienced their last moments. And that can bring you up short. So I can only begin to imagine what it's like when you're actually experiencing and going through a recovery situation where you begin to have confidence that you've uncovered something that connects to a specific individual.
And are there cases, you mentioned, you know, many cases where, as you said, remains have already been removed, or, you know, locals, maybe in the 40s, were pulling people away, burying them in the adjacent cemetery. Are there times where your team or broadly the groups you're working with are identifying a particular aircraft and, you know, we've confirmed that, yes, this is the aircraft that crashed here. This was the site. You know, we know these three people were aboard. Then is there a step from there to then, you know, go to the local cemetery where there are unidentified remains buried or something, or to try to, are there steps then to try to reconnect those things?
There can be. It's all case by case. You know, so it's difficult to generalize because each specific case generates its own specific and unique. For instance, I just don't remember if it was one of the UW-MIA cases before I joined or if it was a colleague's case. But long story short, and I promise I'm getting back to your original question.
Take your time.
There was a wonderful overhead shot of from shortly after the incident during World War II of the impact crater that a single engine fighter made. And it was like, it's just, say, south of that farm road that's just east of this main village lane. So everybody's like, this is where we need to dig. They go out there. They start digging. Nobody can find anything. Well, it turns out that the next generation after the war, one of the generations after the war, the family that owned the farm, moved the farm road. And finally, somebody talked to somebody. You know, I don't remember all the details. I wasn't there. I've heard this story like second or third hand at this point now, right? But the overall point holds. Somebody talked to a member of the local community, and they're like, oh, you're looking for where the old road used to be. Like, it's there. Went over there, and they started finding you know, what they thought they would see. And so my point with all of this segue to your question is that these cases are so idiosyncratic. They're so specific to that thing. And then you have the fragmentary physical records and documentation that exists from the Defense Department and the U.S. Army. And then you also have, this is something I was not prepared for, but you go over and, you know, we're working in European countries and, you know, I've primarily been in France and Belgium and oftentimes very small towns is where we're based out of. We have a hotel we're staying in. And then everybody starts saying, are you the Americans here doing the World War II stuff? Yeah. You know, and we try to be nonspecific because we don't want people coming out disturbing the site. You know, well, yeah, that's what we're doing. They're like, oh, well, are you interested in like World War II planes? We're like, sure. And they're like, okay, over there is a Messerschmitt. Over there is a Spitfire, back there is a Lancaster, three hills that way is a Mosquito. Like in one of the places I was at, it was one of the staff at the restaurant I was having dinner at. And this young man was high school aged, early college age, maybe. I mean, you know, but younger than me. And he was clearly well removed from these events, but they were part of the living memory and the living history of these communities. And that was something that still, We've had some eyewitnesses to some of the events that we're investigating. And if we haven't had living eyewitnesses, we still have an oral history, a history in the communities, right? And so we have this missing aircrew report and it'll say this and this happened, but then you get there in the area and they're like, well, yeah, but actually, what about this? And then there will be conflicting reports of like, oh, well, somebody remembers that in the village over that way, they buried some people from the war, right? And then somebody remembers, well, maybe it was over here. And then the American Graves Registration, right? They have information. And so it gets to be a very complicated cold case, would be a good analogy, right? People can think of cold cases they see in TVs or documentaries or other podcasts, right? And you begin to try to unravel this. And this is why our project has realized we need people with diverse backgrounds and a wide array of skill sets, right? We need historians. We need people with medical and forensic knowledge, people with archaeological knowledge, people with biochemical knowledge, people with all kinds of knowledge. And we try to pull whatever resources we have to try to bring about a successful conclusion of each of these.
So no such thing as a typical case.
In my experience, no. And I have a colleague who he's doing some research where he's trying to track, actually I have another colleague and they're trying to work on similar things, is they're trying to look at movements, just the recorded movements in and out of the various temporary and then permanent American cemeteries that were set up throughout Europe during and immediately after the Second World War. And, you know, it's going on many, many decades now. These records are breaking down, both metaphorically and quite literally, every decade that goes by. And they're trying to use a variety of historical and other analytical techniques to do this. And I have several colleagues working on it. And it's fascinating what they're able to find out. You know, like, well, it says that all the people that were, you know, in this theater of operations went to this cemetery. But actually, there was a small part that went over here. And no one's ever looked over here for, you know, and again, I'm generalizing and maybe hyperbolizing a bit, and I'm speaking too much for other people's specific work than my own knowledge, but I'm trying to give a sense of how complex this can be, or not can be, but how complex it is.
Right.
Wow. This is incredible. Thank you so much for sharing some of this with us. Can you talk a little bit about the project you're working on right now?
So the last project we worked on, we worked on it for 3 seasons, it's ongoing. We've made a recommendation for what should happen next, but that needs to work through the process. But it was a large multi-engine craft, a B-26, in Belgium. I don't recall the exact date of the loss. And there was, I believe, potentially 3 service members that were lost with the craft. But between shortly after the incident, local individuals, and then Graves registration, all but 1, we believe, have been recovered. And so we've been trying to identify the last service member that went down with this aircraft. And we've been working. It's a large site. And it appears that this craft may have exploded both in the air and on the ground. And so wow. Material related to the last incident covers a large span of this area of forest and farm field. And so we've been kind of trying to make sure that we've investigated all of the areas that could be associated with this to their fullest extent.
Wow. It is really, really is incredible. It's just, it's powerful stuff. Are you aware, Brett, of, are other countries pursuing similar things? Are there similar programs in other countries? And I'm not trying to be sort of jingoistic about it, but this is something that I don't mind saying I'm proud to say that my country cares enough about people lost 80 or more years ago, and that it still matters. That makes me proud. That's gratifying to me, as sobering as it is. I'm not trying to be a jingoist about it, but are there comparable programs that you've encountered in other countries?
Yes and no. There are comparable programs in some countries, okay. And then there are countries that don't currently have much of a formal program or structure for pursuing this particular goal. The ways that various places go about this cover a wide spectrum, from relatively low intensity to very high intensity efforts. And there's no specific way to generalize it. But again, I echo your comments as well. I, as an archaeologist, very few things I do very much matter to more than a handful of people, right? You know, I can go write a research paper on something and it has an impact within a very specialized community of people that may be interested in that subject matter or area of the world or whatever the case may be that I've done some research on. But I have never mentioned this to anyone who doesn't immediately stop what they're doing and want to know more. Because this covers a subject, this covers military service, military sacrifice that has touched almost all of our lives and all of our communities in some way or another. And I always feel very humbled to be part of it and echo your comments that I'm glad that I'm not glad this work has to be done.
Right.
But I'm glad that unfortunately, because it is a reality and it does need done, I'm glad that there are organizations associated with our government that are trying to honor this commitment and honor the promises made to our service members, regardless of how much time may or may not have elapsed since their service.
My goodness.
Can you tell me how many different cases have you been on?
I've only been able to work on the one site.
Okay.
It was a multi-year series of related missions, and that has spanned my association with the UWMIA. I have only been on since 19, and then there was some COVID delays and some other things. So I hope to continue to work on missions in the future and you know, expand kind of my experience with this. But, you know, we'll have to see what happens moving forward.
You have to think that your work, when you are able to bring somebody back, that has to matter, you know, so much to the families to get that closure.
Hopefully there'll be some time in the presentation this evening, and I'd like to show a clip if I don't end up talking too long, which is always dangerous, from a documentary that our group made, and some of the team members that have experienced this have talked about it, but I've talked with people in the team and I've talked to people from communities that have experienced this. And one of the things that's really been eye-opening to me is I have relatives I've never met from the Second World War service, you know, the either one I know at least passed in the war and others passed before I remember meeting them. I had family members that served that never talked about. So this is just not something that I was used to thinking about, but families that don't have the closure, families that have a missing member from even as far back as World War II, much less more recent conflicts, right? There are holes in those families. There are missing seats at family tables. There are missing gaps in communities. And I have not participated directly, but I've seen the stories, I've seen the coverage of whole communities turning out to honor the fallen service member and to help a family get closure on this thing that's been ongoing. And that has been, even to see it at 2-3 removes, right? Only to learn about it and to hear about it has been powerful and humbling and kind of renews my commitment to wanting to try to contribute to this kind of work whenever I can.
You know, Brett, you mentioned the American cemeteries, and there's a stereotype and a cliche that, you know, Americans traveling, I would say in Europe in particular, you know, we're loud, and if you don't understand us, we'll just speak English louder. We're boorish and all these sorts of things. But, you know, I found in some of my limited European travels, I've seen some of these American cemeteries. In the UK at Duxford, there's an American museum that's devoted just to American air crews. And I found that when you go back, at least, and you're talking about the World War II era in particular, that even to this day, that there's a warm reception and there's a sense of appreciation. I want to say gratitude, but it's not that old cliche of, well, we came over and saved you, you know, but an appreciation of the alliances that were formed and things back then. Is that your experience as
Absolutely.
Well?
Absolutely. When you're directly talking about, you know, European and American alliance and cooperation during World War II, like everything else about what America is or could be or shouldn't be that people may think drops away. And it instantly becomes like, yeah, remember that time we all cooperated and did the really big, really important thing and everybody sacrificed a whole lot? Like, that was incredible. And I'm not trying to talk it down or make light of it at all.
No.
Like, it really becomes that simple, right? People boil it down just that simple. Like, it was incredible. Like, and whole swaths of people across multiple generations on both sides of the Atlantic made incredible sacrifices. Some made the ultimate sacrifice. And people still remember that, and it still means something. I mean, every one of these towns that I've stayed in or visited doing this kind of work, there is a small memorial to the events of World War II. We just stayed in one where a German tank fell off the bridge and the town paid to have it hauled out of the small river, and they restored it. And there's a whole diorama display and signs about, well, okay, in the morning of this, the Germans came through as part of this battle, and then this happened. And I mean, this stuff is incredibly present. World War II is more present in the handful of places I've been to in Europe than anywhere outside of a museum I've been to in the United States.
And it's for us as Americans, I mean, we've been so blessed and so lucky for our 200 plus years that with notable exceptions, for us, war happens over there, you know, almost literally over there, like as the song goes. And as you travel through all these towns and these amazing areas in Europe, you're finding the places where war was in your yard. You know, the war came to you. Oh, the war's 2 miles away. Well, now the war is in your backyard. And it's so hard for us to even fathom that.
One of the things our project has done, tried to do, and I believe that our leadership team has done an excellent job, is develop local connections, develop relationship-building networks, right? And so we've hired some local archaeology students from the university to be translators and to work with us. And one of our translators' family took us on a driving tour. And this is, we basically started at one end of these series of valleys and communities and like, well, this was my grandmother's house at the time. And do you see all the bullet holes across the ridgeline? That was from when the Germans were on that hill firing at the Shermans down there on the third day of the advance for the Battle of the Bulge. And then when they retook the village, that's, I mean, you know, and then here's Aunt So-and-so's house and you can see that hole right there. That was when this counterattack happened. And I mean, it's this incredible living history of literally in people's yards and farmsteads and houses to this day. And then, you know, I grew up on the East Coast, so could see Revolutionary War sites and Civil War sites, Gettysburg, Antietam, Valley Forge, places like that. And they were powerful. And even at a young age, not surprisingly, I ended up being an archaeologist, right? I had an interest in history, wanted to do all the historical things. But they don't have the same impact because I think they were just long enough ago, right? That a couple years ago on one of the side trips we did one of these projects, I was able to go to Omaha Beach. And that was just, I mean, I just had to be quiet for a little bit. And you all, you fine gentlemen don't know me that well yet, but me being quiet for a little bit is a rare and unusual thing. But just standing there and realizing where you were and looking up the cliff faces, right? And looking up the draws that the soldiers would have had to storm to get off the beaches and standing on the beach and knowing all the stuff that we know about what happened on that day. I can't describe it because it's a very intangible thing. And because why I bring this up is because of what you just said is it did happen over there, right? We don't have a parallel experience, I don't think, right? A parallel thing that we can do.
Well, and I've always thought that part of it too was, you know, it's for us, you know, here in the great state of Wisconsin or, you know, almost anywhere from say here west, certainly I grew up on the West Coast. You know, oh my gosh, look at this church. It's 100 years old. And, you know, I remember a particular church visiting in Europe is actually in the former East Germany of all places. But, you know, this church took 400 years to build. And, you know, they finished it in 1200 and people are still using it. So I think part of that too is as a percentage of a nation's history, it's almost like talking about like a geological timescale, right? That for these European countries, World War II wasn't that long ago as a slice of their whole history. And I don't know, maybe I'm way off base, but I wonder.
No, like I said, I was unprepared for how present it is in the minds and memories of people that weren't alive when it happened, right? I figured, okay, sure, there's going to be some people that were alive when this went on, and that's still a big deal. There's going to be some people that are interested in it, but it just seems like everybody in these communities, and I don't know, I don't spend a lot of time in large, big cities, but in these smaller communities, like there's a very direct and to me feels very tangible connection to these events, even going on, let me do math, 80 some years later.
Well, God forgive all of us if we ever completely forget.
And I think that's an important thing too, is one of the things I think is that I like sharing what our project is about. I like sharing the mission. I like sharing my experiences. But I think that, you know, we have to remember why we're interested in this stuff and why we need to remember about this stuff. And increasingly, as we lose due to age, the direct participants in these events, I think all of us that know the history of these events in any way, however small that may be, we need to continually stress just that message. Like cannot happen again. You know, we don't need to have whole generations of people experiencing these kinds of things.
Do you have, or maybe you've already described it, sort of a most powerful moment on the trip or on any of the cases?
I think the most powerful thing for me was my first time going to an American cemetery. For anybody listening to this who hasn't seen one of these, if you can picture, if you've been there in person or you can picture it in your head, Arlington Cemetery in Virginia, the American cemeteries overseas are just smaller scale versions of that. So you just have acres and acres of you know, well-lined up white crosses and just looking at that. And then I'm of an age now, I keep forgetting how old I am, right? I'm in my mid-40s in my head, I'm about 23 years old, right? But looking at that and then looking at the markers on the gravestones and doing math, and realizing that these young men died you know, many of them before their 25th birthday. That was a powerful, humbling experience. And it's things that I think all of us that are familiar with the history of that era and that period know, but to quietly reflect on it while you're going through one of these cemeteries is incredibly powerful and moving for me.
That is really remarkable stuff. Brett, I think we're just getting close to the end here, and I hate to say it because this, I think we could go on and on and on. I use the term noble to describe the work that you're doing, and I say that to you as a representative of anybody and everybody involved in this. And you know, of course, we're thanking you for coming and spending time on the show and for coming to our museum to speak. But I think far more importantly, thank you and your teams and everyone involved for keeping this work alive.
I appreciate that. I really want to stress that I am trying to relate my personal take on things, but I am one small part of a much larger project, and there are a great number of people that are working and making efforts to pull this together, our leadership on a daily basis. My thanks is to them for making it possible for me to even have a project to participate in and to be involved. So I'll echo your sentiments to thank the larger team.
So with that then, as we wrap up, how can people find out more and how can they help?
We have a website, which I should have remembered the exact thing. But if you
Google is your friend.
Google UWMIA, and you can find us, and you can see some basic information there. And then I'll be sharing some other websites and a QR code of the presentation tonight. And I could also work with you guys if you have anywhere you want to get that information out.
Each of our episodes has its own landing page. So, Chris, let's coordinate and let's make sure that the links and things that you've got there when we publish this episode live there as well.
Yeah, so look, we can work together and do that. This is all new to me. I'm learning the whole process of kind of publicizing an organization, and so I didn't come prepared. But
that's refreshing.
I can get prepared.
That's great. Well, so everybody out there, please do. Either go to the landing page for this episode and you'll find some links, or you can simply Google UWMIA and learn more about what you're doing. And I'm assuming there's an option for people to maybe contribute some funds.
There is, yes.
To help support it.
Yeah, we'll get all that information on the landing page, and then on our own webpage, there's information for how to begin that process.
Oh, that's great. Well, again, hats off to all involved for a noble pursuit. I can't come up with a better word than that. So with that, thank you again, Brett, for joining us here today and for making the trek, no matter how far you had to come in, I think today's high was 12, and that was a heat wave for us. So making the trek out in the cold weather to come and speak. Thanks, as always, to everybody out there who's listening. Thank you for subscribing. We really appreciate the reviews that you leave on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, anywhere else you can get podcasts. When you go to inspire.ea.org and find the landing pages for these episodes, we really appreciate the comments you leave there. I can't overstate that enough, that those are the reasons that we're able to continue doing these shows and bringing them to people, is because we know that we're reaching you and it's making an impact. So thanks everybody for listening. Please keep it up. Please keep following us. Check out UWMIA and the great work that they're doing. And with that, we'll catch up with you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.